Well, brethren, I believe that all of us are aware of, to some extent at least, of things which are happening in our world, particularly what's happening in Russia and the Ukraine, in Europe. I think we've entered, today marks maybe the 10th day of war between Russia and the Ukraine. This is something which may be shocking for us, but it's something which has been building up for many years. Russia has made movements. They have built up military forces and done maneuvers along the border, threats and intimidation. This has been going on for a long time. But it was not the actual conflict until recently, but it was not peaceful. I visited with one of our elders who had gone over to that area to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles about 4 or 5 years ago. And he talked about the stress that the people were under, and even where they kept the feast, just how close they were to the border and how close they were to those who were in doing military maneuvers. Sometimes you could hear jets flying over that were encroaching on Ukrainian airspace, that they knew that there were tanks. And the brethren talked about it, living under that constant kind of threat. And it was interesting because I remember him saying, you know, here we are celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, looking forward to peace, to a time when God's peace and his kingdom will be established on this earth. And yet, seemingly just over the horizon, looms the threat of war. Brethren, we look forward to a time when there will be peace. It won't be temporary. It won't be threatened. It will be a just and lasting peace, a permanent peace. The title of my message today is A Just and Lasting Peace. Now, many believe that what's going on right now is the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin's desire to reestablish the Russian Empire. Something which, of course, our nation has done throughout its history. We've had empires and empires that go to war against each other because they have conflicting interests or they desire to control certain areas which are rich in resources. And we know that prophetically there will be empires that will rise. Now, many are wondering if this buildup and war with Russia and the Ukraine will actually lead to World War III. We've probably all heard people speculating about that. If you're on social media, if you're watching the news, we see a lot of people wondering about this. And we see nations gathering themselves, preparing. Yesterday, I think Germany declared that they were going to double the amount of money which they spend on their military. And they'll do this very rapidly and very quickly. So it does make us consider the outcome. How will this go? Now, how many of you have heard of World War II? Okay, very good. World War I. See, it kind of makes sense. If there's a one, then you'd expect there to be a two in order for there to be a three. How many of you have heard of World War Zero? World War Zero is a term which many historians have given to a war which happened at the beginning of the 1900s, the Russo-Japanese War, the Russian and Japanese conflict. Happened in the Pacific. It happened in a part of northeast China, Manchuria, and it was fought primarily in Korea. See, what you had were two empires. You had the Russian or the Empire of the Bear, that which is Russia, and then you had the Japanese Empire of the Sun. And at that time in our history, empire building was all the rage. All the nations were trying to establish territories and control or colonies in certain areas because there was wealth and there were resources. It was one of the first, I don't know if you'd call it an arms race, but it was who was going to control the majority of the world. Everyone was in on it. France, Britain, Germany, countries that don't even exist anymore. This was happening all over the world. And when you have countries that are establishing themselves all over the world, it's very easy for this to escalate. You know, if you're at war, you know, Germany and, say, France, it was very easy for them to have colonies in South America who are suddenly at war. Well, the Russo-Japanese War officially began in 1904. They were arguing over who would control Manchuria. This is a very large portion of northeast China. And it began, you know, there was tensions. There was the Russians were definitely a larger army. They had far more men. I would say at least three times the amount of soldiers that Japan could field. But the war began when Japan moved and did a surprise attack on the Russian fleet. Sound familiar? If you know your history? Well, what this did was it gave them an early advantage. It gave them a leg up. They'd already inflicted a devastating blow to the Russian forces. And they fought, again, primarily on land in Korea and then in the Sea of Japan. Now, casualties during this war that extended about 2 years were incredibly high. Some estimate between 130 and 170 individuals simply killed on the battlefield, not counting the many thousands who died of their injuries later on, those who died because of sickness and disease, privation during the war and then thereafter. But it had also essentially almost bankrupted both nations. There was talk of, and what did lead to a rebellion and a revolt in Russia. And in 1905, the Japanese decided they needed there to be a brokered peace treaty. Now, surprisingly, actually to the world, who they turned to was the United States and to the new and young president, Theodore Roosevelt. Now, how many of you know the name Teddy Roosevelt? Yeah. He's kind of famous in our American history. His face is carved into a mountain in South Dakota, Mount Rushmore. If I just ask, what's Teddy Roosevelt maybe most famous for? Okay, well, yeah, we have teddy bears. But then we also have San Juan Hill. The Rough Riders, yes. The Spanish-American War. And teddy bears. He was an interesting man. He covered everything from, you know, charging up the hill, guns blazing, leading men to an American victory, to establishing the majority of our national parks and conservation efforts in our nation, which we still enjoy and are thriving today. And all the things that most of us cuddled with as children, teddy bears. He was a loved figure. Not as much at his time. People were definitely detractors of him. He had big ideas, bold ideas. And many of them did not consider him fit to be president. In fact, the only reason he was president was because they gave him the vice presidency to get him out of the way. And then the president was assassinated. And Teddy Roosevelt became, I believe, the 26th president. And he was the youngest president in our nation's history at that time. So it's interesting that two empires that were going to war, incredibly expensive, an incredibly bloody war, were willing to turn to this man to broker a peace deal between their two empires. Now, in America, his own detractors said that this was ridiculous. They saw Teddy Roosevelt as a warmonger, you know, who was always wanting to lead the charge. He was compared to others throughout history. And so everyone watched what would happen. This man who had been a politician in the East, who at one point in his life had traveled to the West and become a cowboy, who had raised his own regiment of former cowboys and soldiers to fight in the Spanish-American War, who was now president, would he become a peacemaker? Teddy did some things which were unusual. On September 5th of 1905, he invited the delegates from Russia and Japan to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He had them arrive, and he brought them aboard the presidential yacht. And he did some things which I think were kind of ingenious. They were going to have a state dinner, a luncheon, actually, except there was no table. Everyone had to stand. Had to stand and move around and rub elbows, hold their food in their hands. It was a little undignified for everyone. But it ensured that no one was offended because of where they were sitting at the table. No one was on the right hand, no one was on the left hand. It was an even playing field. At some point during this meeting, Teddy Roosevelt raised his glass and offered a toast. And he led them in this, and he said, In the interests of all mankind, there is a just and lasting peace that may be speedily concluded. He asked none of them to respond, but just to hear that toast, to think about it, to consider what this would mean, and that it would be in the interests of all of mankind to have a just and lasting peace. Now, this was not something which happened easily. He didn't wrap it up during their luncheon or their dinner. It took a month. The treaty at Portsmouth was a treaty that allowed both nations to save face and gave both of them at least some victory. Now, the outcome of this Portsmouth Peace Declaration, or peace treaty, it shocked the world. It definitely shocked the detractors of Teddy Roosevelt, a man who, quite frankly, loved a good fight. You know, he was, part of his hobby the entire time he was president was boxing. He would invite men into the White House, into a gym which he had built, a special ring, and he would box every day. And he demanded that they not take it easy on him. Now, admittedly, most people look around and say, you know, he invited professionals. They took it easy on him. But he loved that. And it's interesting that what he truly wanted more was peace, a just and lasting peace. He was a man who gave us the term, speak softly, but carry a big stick. This treaty was a lot of work for Teddy. Some say that during this month long of going back and forth and back and forth, that at times he was tempted to reach across the table and bang their heads together. Of course, that is not peace, is it? That is not a just and lasting peace. That might be enforcing a peace, but it's not a true peace. And so he didn't do that. One of Teddy's friends and critics, after this, as the nation was celebrating, stated that Teddy was the best herder of emperors since Napoleon. You know, we think of herding goats. Emperors are a lot more difficult, cause a lot more trouble, many more problems. After this peace treaty, Teddy Roosevelt in 1906 was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Did you know that? Teddy Roosevelt was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize during his first presidency. He was the first American to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. However, as incredible as this achievement was, Teddy knew that his just and lasting peace would not last forever. That it was wonderful, it was good, they celebrated it. He said, "This is good for the Empire of Russia. This is good for the Empire of Japan. And frankly, it's pretty good for me too." It definitely elevated his status. It elevated the status of the United States of America as a world player. People began to look to the United States as someone who could make a difference in the world. However, having looked at what was being contested, at, in the end, the desire to control, the desire to spread their own power, to have wealth, that it would only be a matter of time before these forces would again be at war. Teddy Roosevelt said, "Sooner or later, the Japanese will try to bolster up their power by another war. Unfortunately for us, we have what they want most, the Philippines. When it comes, we will win over Japan, but it will be one of the most disastrous conflicts this world has ever seen." He said that almost 40 years before the Japanese did the exact same tactic, attacking our Navy in the port of Pearl Harbor. Theodore Roosevelt was a peacemaker. It wasn't something that necessarily came naturally to him. But like everything that Teddy Roosevelt did, he did it with his whole heart. He threw himself into it. Anything worth doing was worth doing it with your all. It was something that he was willing to strive for. He was zealous for it. A just and lasting peace. Brethren, how wonderful would that be if we had a just and lasting peace in our world today? If we had leaders who were willing to sacrifice for a just and lasting peace. But you see, our world doesn't truly know what that is. But a just and lasting peace will someday come. Let's turn to Isaiah 9 and verse 6. Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. Again, this is quoted so often and kind of misunderstood. A prophecy of Christ. Isaiah 9 and verse 6. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. And from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. This is a zeal which will make even the zeal of Theodore Roosevelt pale. It is a zeal which will establish peace that will be just and will last forever. Brethren, you and I are called to be disciples of Christ. And if he is the Prince of Peace, and it is the way of peace that we must be learning now. If we want to be in God's kingdom of peace, we must become like he is. He himself said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." So how do we do this? It's a pretty big task. Brethren, point number one to this message of a just and lasting peace is we must learn what peace truly is. We must learn what peace truly is. Because the truth of the matter is, brethren, none of us have ever experienced true peace. There's always been conflict. The word peace, the Cambridge English Dictionary, states this: peace is freedom from war and violence. Well, that's true. It says, especially when people live and work together happily without disagreements. Well, that's actually more important than and more difficult than freedom from war and violence. Actually being able to live peaceably with those who are around you. Webster's dictionary states peace as this: a state of tranquility or quiet, something which doesn't happen often in homes with children. And frankly, this world, we are children. There's always noise. There's always conflict. There's always squabbles. Who's first? Who does this belong to? Webster's continues and says that peace is also the freedom from civil disturbance. Have we had that? I mean, what is a peaceful protest anyway? Right? And we experienced that over the last couple of years with Antifa and Black Lives Matters that joined forces. And, you know, I remember the CNN broadcast where they're burning the building behind them. And he's like, "Well, it's mostly peaceful." That's not even close. We see other people that are saying, well, the truckers' convoy in Canada, that's a peaceful protest. Except by definition, peace is freedom from civil disturbance. You know, that's one of the accusations that those who in the government have against the truckers is that they're disturbing things. You know, people are having trouble just going to the store. There's difficulties. You know, the blowing and honking of horns, they're disturbing the peace. They say it's freedom from disquieting or oppressive thoughts or emotions. How hard is it to have inner peace? Anybody able to do that perfectly? You know, when I saw the news reports of war in Europe, I didn't have inner peace. My heart clenched up. It's all sorts of things that make us wonder, make us worry, make us afraid. Change. You know, that was something that President Barack Obama ran on. Change. Have we gotten peace from any change? No. It goes on and says, peace is harmony in personal relationships. Anybody ever had a perfectly peaceful relationship? We always disagree over something. Even my wife, who thinks I'm perfect. See, she would disagree about that. That statement would be disagreeable. Peace is also a pact or agreement to end hostilities between those who've been at war or in a state of enmity. Making a peace treaty. But so often, a peace treaty is just where we're going to stop killing each other. But the problem's still there. It's not really healed. And sometimes peace is to say something calming as a greeting or as a farewell. Shalom. This is something that is a part of the Hebrew culture. Shabbat shalom. To say peace. Have a peaceful Sabbath. Now that Hebrew word, shalom, truly means more than the English definitions. Shalom, God's peace, means completeness, soundness, welfare, to be made whole and complete. So often that's what we want when there has been conflict. When we've been hurt, when we've been damaged, we want to be made whole again. We want our relationship to be made whole again, to be completed, to be restored. That's God's peace, which is not the peace of mankind. The peace of mankind and all the peace treaties have historically always led to more conflict. That's one of the statements about the Portsmouth Peace Treaty, was that this led to the rebellion of Russia, the revolt, which led to the Tsar's murder and his family. Communism took place. In Japan, they almost overthrew the government as well because they were so angry because their coffers had been bankrupted. And part of the treaty was that Russia didn't have to pay them for the war. And of course, that made them seek to refill those coffers, to get back what they had lost. That is the difference between God's peace and man's. Man's peace does not mean that they go back to loving one another. It's just, we're going to stop trying to kill each other. That is what we must get over. How many of us have had a contention, a disagreement within our families, our work, maybe the church, our congregations? And we're like, well, we just won't talk about it. Is that healed? Is that peace? Or is it just kicking the can down the road? We have to learn what God's peace truly is if we are to be called sons and daughters of God. If we are to become peacemakers and be a part of the work that God has given to us to create a truly just and lasting peace. This is what we have to be learning and practicing now. Point number two is after we have come to understand what peace is, we have to be zealous for peace. We must long for it. True peace. Harmony. Let's turn to Colossians 3 and verse 12. Colossians 3. In verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, this is God speaking to you, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. These are things which, when everything's going well, when someone's being nice to you, it's pretty easy to be nice to them back. Bearing with one another, forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection, and let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. This is our direction. This is how we're told we're supposed to be all the time. Again, this is easy for me to be, you know, I think, well, with my family, with my children, until they talk back. And then I want to go, smack! What did daddy say? Here, get over here. You know, we have contentions. This is hard. It's not something that you can just say, well, I'm going to be peaceful today. I saw a movie once years ago, and I forget who was in it. I think it might have been Adam Sandler. He was trying to make amends for his life and things he's done, and one of his arch enemies had become a Buddhist. And in his desire to go and apologize to this guy, and the guy's like, I'm at peace, it's all okay, don't worry about it. He's like, well, no, I need to talk to you about this. And I remember when I did this, remember when I did that, and it becomes contentious, and this man who's given his life to peace and becoming a Buddhist, they end up in a fist fight. You know? It's really hard. It's not going to happen because we wake up and we say, I'm going to be peaceful today. You cannot be a peacemaker in the absence of conflict. What are you going to do? Make more peace out of peace? Conflict is the key ingredient. War, offense, hatred. Being a peacemaker means overcoming. And you're not going to do it easy. It means we're going to have to strive for it. We're going to have to work for it. And each and every one of us is required to be a peacemaker. It's funny, I was looking up stories about Teddy Roosevelt, and I Googled Teddy Roosevelt peacemaker. You know what it brought up? His pistol, his .45 caliber Colt Peacemaker that he carried while he was charging up San Juan Hill. There's a reason why people called it that, nicknamed the Colt .45 the Peacemaker, because it was a weapon to be used against your enemies. That is not how you and I are supposed to be. If we look at Ephesians 4 and verse 11. I'm just going to read this one verse. It says, He himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, and some pastors and teachers. Now, some of you may be sitting in your chair going, whew, that's not me. I dodged that bullet. Well, you don't have to be a pastor. You don't have to be an evangelist or a prophet or an apostle. But you do have to be a peacemaker. Every single one of us, every person in every chair in this room is required by God to be a peacemaker. Not a can kicker. And you can look at that both ways. But, sorry, that was a joke. Ba-dum-bum. Sorry. We don't kick it down the road. We don't kick somebody else. We can't, well, I'll just put that in my book of remembrance. We have to be zealous about making peace in conflict. Romans 14. Romans 14. And verse 17. For the kingdom of God is not eating and drinking. You know, it's not, hey, this is great. We've got everything we need. We're a part of the body. We're a part of the church. Sweet, we made it. It's time to rejoice. It's not these things. It's not what's simple and easy, eating and drinking, but righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Spirit. For he who serves Christ in these things is acceptable to God and approved by men. As we do these things, as we serve Christ in these way, or in these ways, it'll have an impact on everyone. Beginning first in our families, in our congregations, in our relationships, and then in the world. Therefore, let us pursue, strive for, go after the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another. That which builds up someone else. You know, sometimes the way that you make peace with your enemy is by building them up. Boy, that goes against human nature. You know, again, the peacemaker. The way you make peace is by crushing your enemy. I'm reminded of a quote from another movie, which I won't quote. It's okay. But that's man's way, not God's way. To make peace is to actually build up the one that you're in conflict with. To make them whole. To edify them. Point number three. Point number three of how it is that we are to have a just and lasting peace, to be a part of God's kingdom, to be sons and daughters of God, we have to know that peacemaking is hard. Peacemaking is hard. And the main reason is because it first involves overcoming ourselves. It involves overcoming ourselves. Again, the world says, well, we'll have peace as soon as we overcome our enemies. Godly peace begins by overcoming ourselves. Peace isn't something that just happens. What is it that breaks out? War. War breaks out. Peace doesn't just happen. Fact is that it's much easier to make war than it is to make peace. You know, we look around and we see where the love of many has grown cold. We see people who get upset about something. Maybe they're in a store. Something's not there or somebody's rude to them. And it's become like a national hobby for people to just freak out and start screaming and yelling and throwing things and breaking things. You know, if I did that when I was two, Mama would have made peace the old-fashioned way. Nobody's learned how to control themselves. They say, nah, just let it go. And hey, we'll film it and put it on YouTube. Make a TikTok out of it. To inspire and encourage other people to do the same. Peace. A just and lasting peace begins by learning to control ourselves, by learning to control our own tongues, our own thoughts. You know, by not saying everything that pops into your head. And instead, grabbing a hold of it, bringing it into submission and saying, why did I just think that? You know, I can't tell you how many times, and I pray this, I should pray it on a daily basis. Sometimes I forget. I ask that God will put his hand over my mouth and not let myself come out. It's a pretty amazing experience when you know that God does that. Something happens, somebody does something, somebody accosts you, attacks you, and my human nature, I turn around and I go, and it's like, and then I hear myself say something that I was not thinking, that was good, that was edifying, that was righteous. And I'm just as shocked as they are. Wasn't what I was going to say. That's what we need to be doing, so that what comes out is edifying. It does build them up. It does make them complete. It is helpful, even if it's correcting. That is doing good. Not letting our own cynicism or our hurt or our desire to get even come out. There was I think he was an English philosopher in the 1600s, who said, what use is it to have a rapier wit if you're never allowed to stab someone with it? We like sarcasm. I know many who call sarcasm another one of their love languages. But it's so easy to cause harm. It's so easy to draw blood, even just a drop or two. Was that really good for the other person? Sometimes. I think Christ is an example of having done that. You know, when after the crucifixion, he is reunited with his disciples, and he's walking along with Peter, and Peter's just been given his directive, and he looks back over his shoulder, and there's John, you know, the one who Christ really got along with well, Christ loved. And he's like, what about him? Christ says, what about him? So what? What if he lives until I return, you know, all the way to the end? I've already told you what you need to do. You need to go and do it. Could Peter have been offended by that? Yeah. I think we all have those opportunities to choose not to be. To choose to realize that this needed to draw a little blood. I needed to be pricked in my heart so that I could realize. You know, one of the things which made David, King David, a man after God's own heart, was after he'd fallen away from God. He'd gotten so far away, he was in danger of losing his salvation, God's Holy Spirit. And Nathan came to him, presented the story and said, you are that man. And David was pricked to the heart. He was cut. He repented. He fell on his knees, covered himself in sackcloth and ashes. How many of us take criticism that way? I don't. I'm better about it than I was when I was younger. Sometimes we do need that nudge, that prick, that poke to make us realize. But we also have to realize that sometimes when we're trying to help someone, one of the greatest things in the world is to hear someone say, you know, I don't mean to offend you, but guess what? Offense. We're not to provoke one another. We have to learn to control ourselves, overcome ourselves. Galatians 5, verse 14. Galatians 5, and verse 14. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even in this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. How do you want to be corrected? How do you want to be spoken to? How do you want to be exhorted, encouraged? This is how we're supposed to speak to one another. To think of them as much, or to love them more than we love ourselves. To think of that before we speak. Even when we're upset. Even when there's contention. Because verse 15 goes on, but if you bite. Yeah, that's a pretty accurate picture. You ever bitten back at somebody? Oh yeah? Arr. You can see dogs do it when they're figuring out who's in charge, or they're, you know, one of them gets too close to their food. They turn and snap at each other. They rend and tear. It says, but if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you be consumed by one another. Brethren, when we allow contentions and hard feelings, resentment and bitterness to become a part of us, to grow within us, then we lash out at one another, we bite, we're actually devouring ourselves. Even when we feel justified. Do you know how hard it is to have righteous anger? I don't know that I've ever had righteous anger. Because righteous anger implies godly anger. And I'm me. There's always a part of me in it. Always. And if we're honest with ourselves, there's always a part of you in it. All we're doing is damaging ourselves. Brethren, the world is going to be at war. It already is. It always has been. There's been wars going on over the last 2 years that none of us are even aware of, because it wasn't big enough to make the news. It will not be until the Prince of Peace sits on the throne of this world that there will be a true, just, and lasting peace. When his kingdom is established on this earth, James 3 and verse 16, but we, brethren, are called to be peacemakers now, learning this. And the only way we can do it is with God's Spirit leading us, helping us to overcome ourselves, developing that love and that zeal for peace. James 3 and verse 16. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. It means when we're trying to get what we want. Well, what's good for me? Because that will be our number one priority in conflict. Godly love, agape, is what's best for them. Verse 17, but the wisdom that is from above isn't like that. It is first pure. Have you ever had really, truly pure intentions when you're dealing with a problem with someone? And then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield. If you're not, you're probably packing a 45, spiritually or physically. Willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. These are all the things that we have to look at in ourselves. And I think of even in the churches of God, most of the contentions and things are not about the black and white of God's law. It's about the things that we disagree about. Well, I think we need to do it this way. Well, I think we need to do it that way. We're not arguing about the true word of God. Verse 18, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Brethren, you are called to be peacemakers. If we are to rule with Christ, again, in his government of peace, we must be learning how to make peace now. Where there are contentions, where there are divisions, where there is hurt, you and I are obligated to make peace, to restore, to make whole and complete relationships. This is where the heart should be. We have to learn what that is, because for the most part, none of us have ever truly experienced it. We have to come to understand what it is that God means when he says, be a peacemaker. And not to seek to win for ourselves. We have to be zealous for it. Peace must be something precious to be worked for, to be sacrificed for. And the way that we're going to do this, brethren, is by first learning to overcome ourselves, to make peace between our nature and the nature of God that he has given to us, that is supposed to be growing within us. And with God's help, we will become peacemakers, and then he will make us righteous. Brethren, I look forward to the time which we're going to have together, fellowshipping, truly in peace, in love, and remembering the life of a woman who I think we all loved, and whose name was Faith. So with that, brethren, I'll conclude and ask Mr. Hines to lead the concluding hymn.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Well, brethren, if you'll all go ahead and rise, we'll conclude services today with hymn number 113, Come Ye Thankful People Come, after which I'd like to ask Mr. Tim McMaster to lead us in the closing prayer. Hymn number 113.